Good morning, everyone. This is episode 30 of the Big COC podcast. It's Friday, January 9th here in Toronto. And we've had a little bit of a break over the holidays, but we're raring to go here in 2015. Lots of things happening musically and operatically, obviously, here at the COC. We're about to open new productions of Don Giovanni and a revival of our production of Die Walküre. And I'm really happy that in the studio and on the telephone, we've got three returning guests. First, I want to welcome back Joseph So. How are you, Joseph?
Very good, thank you.
Great to see you. And Joseph, of course, is well known in Toronto and even further than that, because he also writes for one of the Montreal papers as an arts writer, doing lots of operatic reviews. He writes for Opera Canada, La Scena Musicale, where he has a blog, and also for the British magazine Opera. And next on our list is Jenna Douglas. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, John Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And Jenna, just to remind everyone, is a wonderful Toronto-based collaborative pianist and opera coach. She is a graduate of the ensemble studio here at the COC, and she now regularly works with the COC as part of our musical staff. And we were just talking before, you've got your blog Schmopera, which is going full force. And it's great too. I will say this, like, you know, a lot of blogs, you know, they don't get updated so often, and you're really on it. So it's great to always, you know, be able to see new stuff there.
Yeah, well, thank you.
And you're also now writing for Musical Toronto, is that right?
Yeah, twice a month I'm sending a piece to Michael Vincent at Musical Toronto. The piece gets republished on Schmopera a couple days later, but I write them for him, and it's been great to be part of that.
Yeah, it's another great source for people interested in classical music and whatnot in Toronto. Especially, I think with Michael Vincent now, it's kind of got a new, it seems to have a new blood, and it's
Well, the website looks amazing.
It looks great. Yeah. And last but not least, we're welcoming back Catherine Costanzi. How are you, Catherine?
I am okay, aside from a very, very, very sore back. I am okay.
Oh, no. So Catherine is joining us from her home in North Toronto, and it's great that we're kind of experimenting with this. First time we've had a telephone guest, but I think it's going to work out great.
Yay!
Just to remind everyone, Catherine's a freelance arts journalist and broadcaster, and now a teacher based out of Toronto. Her work has appeared at Mike News, Torontoist, Hyperallergic. Is it XO Jane? Is that how they say it?
Yes.
Okay, XO Jane. She's also now writing for Opera News. And she's getting set to host her very own arts-focused radio show, which will be debuting later this month. So, having made all the introductions, and I'll just introduce myself. I'm Gianmarco Segato, the Adult Programs Manager here at the COC. Some interesting topics, because it's been a little while since the last podcast. I've been able to sort of cherry-pick this time, and there's lots to talk about. One sort of topic that I thought would be interesting to chat about for a few minutes, a couple of North American companies, one on the west coast of the United States and one much closer to home here in Ontario, have kind of come out with a new manifesto as to their future vision. And I first came across what was happening in this regard in Huffington Post. Jennifer Rivera, who writes for them, and we've quoted her stories before. She's a mezzo-soprano, but also a really good arts writer, I think. She did an interview with Chris Mataliano, who's the general director of Portland Opera. And what Portland Opera has decided to do is to go away from the model that they have now, which is like a more traditional season that sort of spreads over, you know, several months. And they're going to a format where it's going to be a spring and summer festival. But beyond that, they are going to sort of go out into the community more, put on productions in smaller venues around their city. They'll still be doing a couple of productions in their large 3,000-seat auditorium. It's almost like American companies. They have these huge theaters. And they said that in this new model, they'll do two productions in the large theater. One will be a musical theater piece, and the other one probably more of a traditional bread-and-butter opera like Bohème or Carmen. But then in smaller 900-seat venues across the town, they'll be doing more experimental works, Baroque works. And the reason for this, I think what's interesting is that according to, you know, all stats, Portland Opera is in good shape. They've never had, you know, financial problems from what they're saying. But they're looking ahead, and the general director is saying things like, the company can no longer assume that it will be able to sell out even the most popular titles in its 3,000-seat venue. And, you know, continuing to have to rely on large donations is always a dangerous business model, according to him. And he says it had become clear that the operating model that so many opera companies, including ours, had been working under is simply no longer sustainable. So this is very much a proactive choice on their part. Now, in the mix of all this, some of their full-time staff, artistic and production staff, will now become seasonal part-time or contract employees. So maybe that's something we can touch on. That's certainly a downside. And I have to, you know, state my own interest there as an employee of an opera company. It's always a bit disturbing to read that kind of thing. So that's the situation in a nutshell in Portland. And then even closer to home, Opera Lyra Ottawa announced at the beginning of December in a press release, their general director, John-Peter Jeep Jeffries, says that the time has come for us to move beyond the old pattern of programming and scheduling an opera season. So what they're proposing for their upcoming season, which hasn't been announced yet, but productions will be, again, spread more broadly throughout the year, offering opera fans the chance to see operas in smaller venues across the region, and many of them contemporary or much more challenging works. So I'm just wondering, with our group here, and anyone can jump in here, what do you see this as perhaps being a larger trend, or why do you think this sort of thing is happening?
I think that I would say, like, leave it to Portland to sort of to think outside the box before they even need to.
Right.
I think that it's not a conservative choice. I think that it's founded in history. Like, we've seen larger companies and smaller companies run into financial issues over the last few years, and so it's not like it's an unfounded thing. And I think that they seem to be sort of modeling it on, Portland seems to be modeling it on the sort of Glyndebourne idea, which is sort of this special once a year thing, rather than, they mentioned something, rather than like going to an opera on a Wednesday night in
right.
March or something. I think it's great news, and I think it speaks to having the ego out of the way and wanting to make it about continuing the opera.
Yeah, I think sometimes these changes sort of shakes everyone up a little bit and creates some excitement. You know, people expect, oh, this is going to be new and so on. Also, I think that perhaps the downside of this, you mentioned it, Gianmarco, is going from full-time yearly employment to part-time employment. I think this is also a way of saving money, let's face it. Because from the sound of it, also Opera Lyra is sort of the same, right? And don't forget, Opera Lyra was it 2 seasons ago had some financial problem, and they had to suspend the balance of a season. I remember that. Also, this downsizing from big houses to smaller houses is quite common. You look at the late and much lamented Opera Hamilton. They've moved from Hamilton Place to the Dofasco Theater, I think it is, right, with about 800 seats.
And now they've closed down.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that smaller companies have the freedom to do this, you know, and larger companies, whom most of the media looks to as, you know, oh, that's opera, they can't, you know, at this point. I mean, everybody looks at the Met, and really the Met is hardly the model for opera companies, you know, at all, especially in this era. But the other thing this reminded me of was something relating to what Scott Timberg has written in his new book. I just did a feature of it that is called Culture Crush, and it's about the creative class and how difficult it is to work and live in the world of culture now. And the workers going to part-time really, really reminded me of that. You know, what do we lose when people can't work in the arts full-time as a culture, as a society, the art form itself? What is lost? I mean, the business model is, yes, definitely smarter, but what is lost in changing it? I think that's something worth pondering. And as again, I said, the smaller companies that are doing it, it's really interesting because how much are they going to be influencing larger companies, you know, if at all, in terms of fundraising models, in terms of, you know, employment models, what about unions? It raises a pile of questions that are really worth pondering in 2015 for any arts company, not just specifically opera.
Well, I was thinking what you brought up about unions. I was thinking that this is the union structure, at least how I know of it in Canada, is going to have to follow suit, because it's one of the things that makes the business model unsustainable is how much you have to pay and how many people you have to pay, regardless of whether you're using them, if you get to sort of theater crew and that kind of thing. But I think what the cool thing that could start to happen is if opera gets sort of downsized into smaller houses, the average person might not notice that as a downsizing, but they might see it as an affordable piece of art they can go see. Whereas they might have written off something at the Met or the COC as something that's out of their budget, or they're not willing to pay for what they would get.
Or it's really far away.
Yeah, or it's really far away, yeah.
It's true when you think about a lot of companies like our own here that we know we own our own opera house. So like you're saying, Catherine, it's pretty hard to, you know, I mean, I have no idea what the future holds. But I mean, to think of giving up a large venue like that. And you know, there are enough companies that are in that position, larger ones. So like you say, that perhaps it's these smaller companies that will be able to go ahead with this kind of model much more easily.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's something that the COC has in common with Portland. Is that Portland owned their buildings?
Yes,
as well.
I'm not sure if they own the actual theater, though. It sounds like they own their administrative buildings.
Okay, but there's something that it definitely helps with their revenue.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
You know, with the COC and the ballet.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's valid. I mean, that's fair. Especially, I mean, we talk about the Four Seasons Center because it's a recent building, and we remember it being built. And so, yes, it would be a shame to part with something like that. And there's no need right now.
Talking about opera companies. Upsizing, downsizing, disappearing, reappearing. Something that's come up in the last couple of weeks. And again, the first story I read about it, and the most detailed one it seems to be, is again written by Jennifer Rivera, but this time on her blog as opposed to Huffington Post. And it seems that there's pretty good chance that New York City Opera, which we talked about on the podcast when it unfortunately had to fold a year or a year and a half ago, whatever it was quite recently, may now be revived. And what's happening is that, and this is something maybe someone here can explain to me once I've gotten through my little intro, because it seems like the board for the company still exists, and I don't quite get how that happens when the company doesn't exist. But anyway, the board of the currently defunct New York City Opera had decided to sell its remaining assets to one of various investor groups who had been vying for the right to revive the company. Now, working under the radar for the past year, asset manager and former board member Roy Niederhofer, after pledging $1 million of his own money and raising a total of over $2.5 million to date, has now won the right, pending court approval, to revive and reinvent the company we all thought that had left us forever. So, to kind of summarize a bit, what they're planning on doing, there's someone else involved here. His name is Michael Capasso. He, for many, many decades, operated opera or Di Capo Opera in New York City. Now, they have not gone bankrupt or folded, but it seems that he'll, you know, in this new iteration of New York City Opera, he'll become kind of the general director. But Di Capo Opera, which he led before, will be folded. What they're proposing is a return to Lincoln Center. And I think this is a sort of a key point because many of the criticisms about what happened with New York City Opera in the end was that it left Lincoln Center and actually tried to put on productions in smaller venues throughout the city. And anyway, whether that was really what, you know, was their final downfall, probably not just that. But what they want to do is return to Lincoln Center. They've chosen the Rose Theater at Jazz at Lincoln Center, which, for what I understand, is at Columbus Circle. This is not a theater I knew about before, but apparently it's a technologically state-of-the-art 1,100-seat venue in the Time Warner Center. It has a huge orchestra pit, wings, fly space, dressing rooms, and apparently excellent acoustics. And it's very central, obviously, for, you know, subway lines and all this sort of thing, restaurants. The plan is to, you know, hopefully start putting on productions there and to go back to the sort of tradition of New York City Opera, which was always to break new ground with innovative productions. And they put on a lot of contemporary American opera, but also to at the same time present compelling versions of standard repertoire. And so this is like the new vision. So again, kind of surprising news. I don't know.
I think all the power to them. You know, if they can do it, great. You know, but I think to revive something like that, it takes more than $2.5 million. And also, you know, there's also the tricky union issue.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. And Yeah, I would agree. Most people thought that the biggest mistake was to leave Lincoln Center and also to basically stop for a year. You know, they should have found Rose Theater back then. When they were doing it. But let's be cautiously optimistic. Hopefully these people know what they're doing. Only history will tell, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they supposedly have an agreement, a five-year agreement with the union that represents the orchestra.
Ah, great.
Some kind of, I don't know what kind of agreement that would be, but anyway, some kind of promise, probably just to work with them. But I'm not clear whether, they'll have a full-time orchestra and chorus again, because I think that was an issue before.
I mean, yeah, it's again, I agree with you, Joseph. It's about being, if the math will add up, then the math will add up, in some way. Like, I don't think anyone was questioning what City Opera was putting out in terms of shows and productions. Perhaps the business model wasn't working, and so we're the changes were under new management, really. There doesn't seem to be enough money yet, but it's just yet.
Mm-hmm. I think this whole thing with DiCapo Opera, it confuses me a little bit. Why is one company winding down and then the CEO going to run New York City Opera? I don't quite understand the logic behind that.
Mm-hmm. There may be no logic to it. I think it might, hopefully it's putting minds together that care about the project.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it takes more than that, but someone that's willing to invest, $1 million of his own money is a promising start in terms of how it looks. Mm-hmm. But
what concerns me about this is that it's still, he says he lives on the Upper West Side, he wants to bring it back, it's going to be all very Manhattan-y. I mean, Anna Nicole, the opera, was a BAM, and more people went to that would have never gone uptown because it was a BAM than have ever gone to an opera, I think, in a really long time, especially in New York, because the ticket prices are kind of horrendous. So this thinking that, we're going to have it back on the Upper West Side, we're going to have it back at Lincoln Center, we're going to put it on at the Rose, we're going to put it on at our theater on the Upper East Side. It's like, why does opera have to be so rarefied like that? You are the New York City Opera, you're not the Met, you can go around to different locations. Why wouldn't you, if you would like to attract a more diverse audience, perhaps, that will help you to break even, hello. I think there's something about this thinking that opera has to stay in this rarefied, upper Manhattan echelon. I find that really frustrating throughout all of this. It's like, why? Why? We're in 2015. It doesn't have to stay there. And it shouldn't stay there. The success of Anna Nicole proved that very well, because the company was in trouble far before they went to BAM. BAM was one of the smarter things they did, and they should have gone down there a heck of a lot sooner. So that is my concern about this, is it feels like it's this old-style thinking towards this, and that's ultimately not doing the art form or the company any favors.
Well, and I wonder if that was not a condition, but I wonder if that was had something to do with the money he's been able to raise. The people giving the money didn't want it to go anywhere but Upper East or West Side.
But then they're dooming it to failure.
Exactly. No, I agree.
Yeah.
The problem is you got to be able to run an opera company without donors at some point. And it's difficult to do, obviously, right?
But that business model is not possible in North America. In Europe, yes.
Yeah.
Most of the opera houses that I'm most familiar with, Germany, is that they are state funded, much more so. Not 100%, but I would say easily 70%, 80%. Ours is what, 20%? Government money?
Yeah, about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I just don't, keeping it in this sort of museum aside, cocoon, I just don't think that's healthy. I don't think that's good for New York City Opera. I don't think it's good for their artists. I don't think it's good for their donors at the end of the day. And it certainly is not good for New Yorkers either. It's really not. So, I don't know. Come on, rethink, guys. Rethink.
if they're obviously hoping to, if New York City, if the opera comes back and we've got a full season announced and everything, the people that they should be looking at getting are the people that didn't know that City Opera fell in the first place. As in, mm-hmm. they should be looking at people that want to just see something good.
Like, exactly.
I saw a show called Anna Nicole. I've been dying to see Anna Nicole live. I haven't had a chance to do it. But, I mean, obviously that draws people, and you can say it's for the wrong reasons, but I think that the piece is great, and yeah. that's my opinion. Yeah. But they shouldn't be... I realize that we're in an opera circle, but they shouldn't be about advertising their renaissance.
Or trying beyond to compete the people with that the care. Met. You know, or trying to compete with the Met, or trying be a part of the Met / Philharmonic world. I just think that's insane, and I think it's old thinking, and... Yeah, I think it'll doom them. I really do. So, but also I think, you know, if you're coming at this as I'm a rich guy who likes opera, how interested are you really at the end of the day in bringing in an audience that you might think, oh, well, they won't want opera. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're coming in with a mindset probably. So that's my concern. More power to them if they can do it. But, you know, I heard this and I made faces when the obsession was it has to be at Lincoln Center. It has to be at the Rose Theater. It's like, no, it doesn't. It can be anywhere. It can be in Prospect Park, for Christ's sakes, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess we'll, you know, obviously follow this with interest and points all well taken for sure. Okay, so this next topic is probably, it seems like every few weeks or every couple months, there's like one topic that creates a lot of buzz online and lots of comments on all the various blogs. And I'm really interested to talk about this today because, as you'll see, we've got three very active arts writers in the room. And this topic is for you. Opera Australia is... kind of in hot water again, it seems. Actually, we were talking about this the other day here at a meeting, and we're like, what is going on with Opera Australia or Down Under stuff?
It's a PR ploy.
Well, Opera New Zealand's okay.
yeah, they're doing okay. They haven't gotten sort of in trouble lately. But anyway, what came out on January 2nd was that Lyndon Terracini, who is the artistic director of Opera Australia, has told two prominent arts writers in Australia that they are persona non grata at his opera house. And the first person to be targeted in this way was Harriet Cunningham of the Sydney Morning Herald. And apparently she received, and I'm taking this from Norman Lebrecht's Slipdisk blog, so, you know, that's the source. She received this email from, I guess, somebody in the media department at Opera Australia saying, "Hi, Harriet. Lyndon is very offended following your article earlier this week. I'm sure this comes as no great surprise. So no, I'm afraid we're not able to offer you any further comp tickets." And then similarly, Diana Simmons of the blog Stage Noise was told a similar thing, that she was also removed from the comp list. And so just to give a bit of background here, just in case people don't know, most opera companies, symphony orchestras, theaters have lists of media who come to their performances, usually the first performance, and you know, the idea is that they will come watch the performance and then write about it afterwards, a review. And for the most part, you know, the review is up to the person writing, you know, what they think about the production. I'll just read you a bit of what Harriet Cunningham wrote and why Mr. Terracini was so upset. So December 8th, she wrote a blog entitled, or an article, I should say, entitled "Why I'm Not Going to the Opera Next Year." And to summarize, basically what she's criticizing is the fact that what she sees happening at Opera Australia is that the seasons are becoming more and more entrenched in conservative repertoire, conservative productions. And she feels that it's kind of interesting because it's more than just a criticism of that. She feels that perhaps even that there's some kind of ulterior motive that the general director is going for here by having in the big city, in Sydney, you know, having this very traditional season. But what he's actually doing in this sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, like the Australian outback, the hinterland, is that, there's lots of touring productions and more experimental works happening outside of the big city. you know, this is, she's criticizing this sort of way of doing things. And obviously, the general director was not very happy about that. As far as I could see, Diana Simmons, I could only find her comments on stage noise was just a few sentences. It wasn't like a long article, but she seemed to be more or less agreeing with Ms. Cunningham. And then there was another interesting blog commenting on all of this by Deborah Jones, No Such Thing as a Free Lunch. And she posted this on January 4th. And just to summarize some of her thoughts on it, she kind of gives a background on this whole idea of comp tickets. She says, in other words, there is an entrenched and rather touching belief on our part that disinterested media coverage plus freebies, free tickets, doesn't equal oxymoron. And she explains that, you know, it's a mutually beneficial relationship normally, that the company, you know, benefits often from good reviews if they get them. And, you know, we've all seen how opera companies quote the good reviews and in their publicity, and then singers are able to do that later on. And even though she points out, I think quite wittily, that, you know, this sort of relationship would be seen as sort of corrupt maybe in other areas, it's quite normal in the arts world. But, you know, I mean, as it stands, he's seems to right now, and it's not that these people cannot go to the performances, but they will no longer be getting the free media tickets. So, sorry, that was kind of a long intro, but I'm really interested to know, you know, how what you think of all this and how it seems to work maybe in our context here in Canada.
Yeah, well, a few things. First of all, refusing comp tickets, this phenomenon is not new. I can give you many examples of this happening in the past. Both, I don't know about Australia, but both outside Canada and as well as in Canada. But I won't go into any details. Okay. And the second thing is, I've been writing reviews for 20 years. I started in 1994, 21 years almost. And I have never, ever had any company said to me that, well, we would like you to write a good review. Never. Ever. Okay, so whatever pressure that a writer feels, from my perspective, is really self-imposed. Okay, I think as writers, we have to be responsible, we have to be musically educated, we have to know what we are writing about, and we have to really, the way I write things is I balance the good with the bad. I mean, I will never lie. But I will always put things in such a way that it promotes the art form, not the company, not the individual. But you know, the whole idea of criticism is to bring people to the theater, right? What is the point of writing something that turns people away? So ultimately, I always aim for a balanced review. Of course, you know, as I said, if something is bad, I will point it out in a diplomatic way, you know. That's my philosophy.
Yeah, I don't think that I've never gotten the sense that I think the only understanding between company and critic is we'll give you a chance to see the show and you write us something about it. But I've never said you have to write something good. I've had moments where I felt like I couldn't write the whole truth, mm-hmm. and it's not about who I'm. It's not about the company. It's because often I have friends in things, and so that can be my only really conflict of whatever. I think like the Deborah Jones piece is interesting though, because it's not there's no official agreement, and every company has a right to refuse. It's their own cost that they're giving away these tickets for potentially not a good review. Even I mean, there. Who's does Rupert Christensen? Does he write for the Telegraph or the Telegraph? I mean, he's. I love reading his stuff for like entertainment value. Because, you know,
does it pull any punches?
No, but I mean, but the weird thing is this seems like such an old way to react to it, especially when you're dealing with people who write for a living. Like, I mean, of course, this fragments of this email that these people received, of course they're going to end up being written about because that's what they do. And so that's fine. I'm sure they weren't entirely ignorant about that fact. But it definitely, I wrote a tiny little bit about it myself. And I said the only new information I found out was that Terracini is tender to criticism. That's the only new thing I found out about this whole thing. And I wouldn't have found out if he hadn't reacted that way. So it's, I mean, you're going to, if you're going to refuse comp tickets to someone, that's your prerogative, but it will get public information very quickly. And opera is a small world. And so for me, it doesn't make them look very welcoming or as a company that kind of knows what's up. That plus compared to their apparently like conservative programming for the season. And
it's a distinct lack of grace from the side of the company. Now, there is one very publicized, although it's not opera, it has to do with Cleveland Orchestra. Remember that? Where a critic was fired by the company, supposedly under the pressure by the musical organization. A music critic. Do you remember that?
No.
It's about 5 years ago.
Oh, are you fired by the newspaper?
Yes.
Okay. No, I don't remember that. But
you don't remember that?
No.
Due to supposedly bad reviews written by this man on their music director, which is Franz Welser-Müst.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, this sort of thing has happened time and time again. It's absolutely nothing new. Now, there has been cases where some publications, I don't know about now, but some publications in the past, they purchased their tickets for their reviewer. So in other words, then there's nothing, they don't owe anything to the company. I don't think they owe anything to begin with.
But no, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't. They don't. But, you know, it's funny because I read last night a article about how David Cronenberg is sort of decrying online critics because internet, you know, writers don't have the same background and knowledge and et cetera, as, you know, normal, quote-unquote, print critics. And it reminded me of this a lot because there is this funny divide that has happened, especially in smaller markets, I think, in my experience, between established print writers, and that's, you know, newspapers, magazines, and online. And I have, I mean, mainly been online myself. I came from zine culture, and I was published in zines in the 90s, but I've mainly, overwhelmingly, been online, and I've learned my craft mainly that way. And I've been writing almost a little longer than Joseph. I started in 91. And I have been barred by companies when I've given bad reviews in the last 2 years. I haven't been told that. I haven't been, you know, given a notice saying, we don't want you here. I am just not invited to their openings anymore because they do have a lot of online writers. I should add that. But they're all cheerleaders. They're all people that are extended publicists for their company. And that doesn't make me feel very good. But at the same time, if that's what the company wants, they only want cheerleaders, I'm happy to step aside and say, hey, you know what? You go there then. If you think that that's being honest to the public, if you think that's being honest to your artists, if you think that's being fair to, you know, the people that you hope to attract, go for it. Because clearly you don't want any criticism. You don't want somebody coming in with a brain, thinking about productions, thinking about art, you know, with that experience. And it's true with every review that you write, you get better, you get more attuned to what's going on, what was intended by the director, what's going on with the actors, the chemistry. You start to notice a lot more, obviously, as you get more experienced in reviewing. I think it's appalling, this idea that we can ban people because we didn't like your review. I think that's appalling. I think it's somewhat justified when, in the case of Joanne Kaufman, she keeps leaving in the middle of shows. That's different. That's not the same thing. Whereas if you are an experienced critic and you're coming from a place of, like Joseph said, thinking about the art form, thinking about, you know, what you've seen, what works for an audience, what doesn't, you are not an extension of that company's publicity team, nor should you be, nor should any journalist be. Mm-hmm. You know, no, any publicity is good publicity. Negative, positive, it doesn't matter. The only thing that's damning is if you get a free ticket to review and you don't. That's wrong. That's bad. That's grounds for barring you absolutely, because you're just riding off a coattail. But if you're coming in with a critical faculty and experience, that ought to be respected.
Yeah, I agree. I just think it was just a misstep by Opera Australia in this case that, I mean, they should have known that, you know, days later everyone's going to know about this thing, which probably happens more than we'll ever find out about. And Maybe some critics are a bit more, I don't know if respectful is the right word, but discreet about what's happened. But I think it's an old approach to dealing with something that you don't like.
Yeah.
It's now online. Like, you have to, now your debates are public, right?
Yeah.
Anyone who's gotten in a Twitter fight has to really choose their words, to stand by what they mean and be doing this publicly, basically.
Yeah. There's also a broader question of criticism itself is, you know, there are different ways to critique a piece. You know, you can be very nasty, or you can really be very balanced, or sort of try to look for the silver lining, but always make sure that you stick to the truth. Because, you know, as writers, we all know there are different ways of skinning a cat, of putting, you know, choosing the right words, rather than being very cutting.
Well, a headline like "Why I'm Not Going to the Opera Next Year" probably gets her a decent amount of traffic, but I mean,
I find it inappropriate. I wouldn't.
It's not actually what she means, right? Because she says that I will go to the opera, by the way. So I get traffic trolling, I guess, and I don't mean
it's
to call
the reality.
It a troll.
It's the big. I mean, this could lead into a huge discussion about journalism and the reality of journalism now. And I mean, really, you know, because it is related and. You know, it is connected to all of this, but really, if you are a critic worth your salt, you know, and you know what you're doing and your editor trusts you, oh my God, you know, you are not shilling for any company or gallery or artist or anything. I mean, it's one thing to have it out there and say, you know, I really love this. I really love this piece of art. I really love this artist, but this didn't work for me. And here's why, you know. But, I mean, everybody's going to express that a little bit differently. And if you have a smart editor, that editor will catch it and say, you know what, this needs more fleshing out, or this doesn't. We are in an age where editors are a vanishing commodity, and that's another problem that is directly related to this, you know. It does point up, you know, the shortcomings of journalism in the digital age. Absolutely. But we're not living in 1953 anymore. So, you know, and thank God, you know. So, I mean, I think it's appalling arts companies would just sort of, oh, well, we give you a free ticket, so we expect a good review. I think that's appalling. It really offends me.
Yeah. No, I mean, to be clear, it wasn't a review of a show, right? It was basically a review of Terracini's management and
right.
the Opera Australia kind
right.
of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, a review is a review. But even that's more, you need to be willing to have people write that about you. I mean, you could ask Peter Gelb
exactly.
about what that feels like, right? Or anyone important with a lot of people and money to manage. I mean, but again, like, you need to be able to sit back and let that be out there. And if anyone has questions for you, Mr. Terracini, then you can answer them, you know?
Right.
But if you leap down the throat, then you make A, more people read the article in question. And B, I think I remember, you know, this is in the same year as Tamara Ivery. And like, Opera Australia is getting a lot of news, not for great reasons.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Exactly. And
it does
give the impression in the public that, you know, you as a company don't like. You know, you will go around stamping out little fires everywhere that might be, you know, oh, inflammatory to you, mon dieu, oh my goodness, you know. And that's not good for your company or your artists or your, like, it's not good for anything going around doing that. Yeah. But, you know, you can't really, I kind of feel like you can't really tell management what to do because they have their own mindset. So, you know, good luck. Good luck.
True, yeah.
Yeah, well, again, this is one of these topics that we'll probably we'll be revisiting. I mean, hopefully not, but as Joseph said, this is not a new thing. And Yeah, it's just interesting, and like nothing's hidden anymore, as we've been saying, and so you know, everybody knows people's reactions these days.
Well, I plan to use only inflammatory headlines just to see what happens.
Yeah, I know, Catherine, you've written about this in other places. I know the mm-hmm. sort of clickbait or whatever they call it kind of mentality, and
yeah,
I mean it's a bigger issue, but it's related. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, for our final topic today, I thought we would look at a story that appeared in The Independent by Jessica Duchin, or Duchin, well-known, again, arts writer in the UK. And she's talking about something very specific here, a specific production, but I thought we could maybe get into a more general discussion of it. And the title of the article was, "Should an Opera Production Be Changed If Audiences Dislike It?" And she's referring specifically to a revival of Christoph Loy's production of Tristan and Isolde that just reappeared at Covent Garden, but the original production was in 2009. And from what I gather from the initial production, there's on stage is this long, high diagonal wall, and that people seated on the left side of the auditorium found it very hard to see what was going on. Their sight lines were virtually non-existent. loud booing resulted on opening night, and anybody would be angry after paying Wagnerian prices, she says, to see this opera. I guess for the revival, the angle of the wall was shunted by a few degrees, and the theater offered reduced price tickets, but the view was still quite restricted. And she points out that unlike many other types of theater, and we think about, like, you know, we always read about these Broadway trials out of the city and that kind of thing, that in those worlds, there's usually a good chance to tweak things like this. But in opera, you know, basically the production's put together, it goes on stage opening night, and there you go. And some of these things, you know, are very hard to change. So her question is, you know, should things, now she's talking, I think, here more about, you know, a set, but, you know, should productions be tweaked or changed at all, yeah, if they don't meet with the approval of the general audience?
I feel very strongly about this actually. Mm-hmm. I know a lot about this production. It is true that you, on one side, you cannot see what's going on because of the design of the production. And I really think that stage designers, set designers, must take into account the shape and the sight line of everyone paying audience who buy a paid seat, so that they have a decent view. Of course, the people that sit in center orchestra is going to have a better view than the side orchestra. But you should not design a production that reduces the view from the side orchestra audience even more than normal. That's not fair. And there was a lot of complaints about this. Hepner sang in this, you know, way back in 2009. And there was a lot of complaint, and it forced Comic-Con to refund the tickets to some people. But they didn't have a blanket policy, so that's not right, right?
I mean, how does the production make it?
Absolutely.
Like, really, how do you get to opening night and no one's either walked over to that side of the theater or no one seems to care? This is ridiculous.
Absolutely. You know, the people who are in charge got to catch these problems earlier in the process.
I fear that they've weighed the sort of director name and director's idea, director whatever, over the audience, which is insane.
I agree.
But it obviously happened when you get to, it's not even just like, you know, Don Giovanni is Superman. It's like, you can't see, you know, I have this thing with directors that want to be creative. It's fine. But no, like, the majority of audiences will buy a lot of what you do if you use the piece to inform it. I know that that might sound really boring or really conservative, but if it's not in the piece, you can't make it happen. You know, if it is, I might not have seen it before, and you see something and you illuminate this part of the piece that actually works. That's happened for me before. But this isn't even talking about sight lines. This is talking about, you know, a director showing off his brain or something, when it doesn't necessarily work. And that is not more valuable than audiences. I think the difference between the Broadway workshop, like a workshop idea or sort of tweaking, is because they care about what the audience thinks because they plan to make money, maybe. Mm. Now, that's a different situation with opera companies. But if you don't care what the audience thinks to the point of them not being able to see, and you don't have a plan for what those people might feel like if they're upset, I mean, then you're not making things for your audience.
Right.
Then you're just, people are patting each other's address books saying, look who I know this director. And this director says, you know, I read this book about Jungian philosophy or psychology, and now I made this opera. You know, it's not the opera. That's just someone putting on an art display, and that's fine if you can see it.
Yeah, this art for art's sake stuff, I can see where people who aren't directly in the arts world and maybe don't go to things like opera or performance art, you know, I could see where they would read something like this or come across this kind of thing, the story, and feel like, see, those artsy people, see, they don't care. And it really does the art form no favors when you design something that half the audience can't see. And never mind, I mean, and Joseph, you've seen this production, so you can speak to it, whether or not it's effective and it works, or if it's just capital A art. You know, capital A art, there is a place for it, but I feel like it's not in a big auditorium, you know? And it's not, I mean, opera tickets are expensive in most cities, and this one included. And, you know, you can't, I mean, it's so unfair, but it's also, as Jenna rightly said, how did this get past anyone, you know?
Exactly.
How?
It should have been caught early in the process.
Well, it shouldn't have ever been designed. It should have been shot right down in the first concept meeting.
Well, how many revivals has this production had?
Right.
This must be the third.
So three general directors have prioritized this director's idea over what the audiences can experience.
Yeah.
And
that's
amazing to me.
That.
That's appalling.
It brings to mind this one other real scandal from Dusseldorf, is Deutsche Oper am Rhein in Dusseldorf, the Tannhäuser. Remember
we talked about it.
Yeah.
And actually, there was only opening night performance. And the day after that, they turned the whole thing into a concert performance. A good friend of mine, a retired Canadian soprano, Jeanette Zaru, she lives in Dusseldorf, and I'm very good friends with her, and she told me, she went to opening night, and she said that people fainted, because the production, now this has nothing to do with the actual physical set, but has to do with the stage direction. They superimpose on Tannhäuser the whole Nazi thing, where whole Holocaust, where people on stage were stripped and they went to the gas chamber and so on. And there were audience in, Jeanette said that there were audience that fainted.
I mean, there's probably a few trigger points in something like that.
In Germany,
older audience going to the opera, I mean, what do you expect?
Why in the world didn't they decide to tone down or whatever, to make changes earlier in the process?
But I'd love to ask the director what the point is, because if you can validate it for me, that's totally fine, right? But, I mean, if it's just about adding my own taste to something, you know, then that's when it just gets to me, and that's what alienates audiences.
Yes.
I mean, if you're, like, to answer your question, Gianmarco, I think production should be changed if audiences have reactions like this to it. It's not like, you know, I thought the Leporello was a little bit too buffo. Like, that's opinion. But I think that it would say a lot if you're listening to the audiences. And there are things that the people that create art can learn from the people observing art.
Jenna.
Or maybe just ask people that, you know, aren't directly doing artsy fartsy things 800% of the time, part-time math.
Exactly.
But, you know, because sometimes I feel like people get too cocooned in their arts world and they lose perspective on what is a good idea and what is not a good idea.
Yeah.
And I feel like there needs to be the keep it real police. Yeah. Coming in more often than not into some places just to say, Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, and this is, again, this goes back to our last topic. This is where maybe the role of critics might be sort of maybe important. I don't know. But I feel like we are the members of those Keep It Real Police, and we do go and say, yeah, or, or I don't know. I mean, you know, she brings up Klinghoffer in this article, which is, I think, a really interesting point, because that opera has aroused so many different reactions from so many different camps. It did when it premiered, and it has no less now, and I'm glad they didn't cancel it, and I'm glad they didn't change it.
But you don't get to listen to people that are protesting but have not seen the opera, which
That's right.
so many of those people profess to not having seen it. Those people don't count.
Right, sure. You know, but I feel like, you know, well, it's not a question of, oh, maybe we should change it if the audience doesn't like it. Maybe you shouldn't present it in the first place if it's, like, you know, half the audience can't see it, for instance. Design 101. Or, you know, let's do a nasty thing in Germany, you know, like, that's...
That seems to be the hot button, because I was in Dresden just in November, and I saw a Daphne. Now, we all know Strauss Daphne is about Greek mythology, right?
Yeah.
Well, but this guy, this director, superimposed a totally different story on top. Daphne herself turned into this historical person called Sophie Scholl, who was an anti-Nazi activist during the Nazi Germany, and she was captured, tortured, and killed. And so you're not watching Daphne at all, you're watching Sophie Scholl. And Apollo, who was sung by Canadian tenor Lance Ryan, become a Gestapo chief. And it's unbelievable. And all the men, the chorus, they were all in Gestapo uniforms carrying machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
I sat there, I thought, what the hell is this?
Well, it's just not the piece.
No.
Right? And you know what? I always think, like, if directors want to keep doing this, they better start writing their own operas. Because what they're doing they're not the pieces that we've seen, you know?
No, they're not.
And, you know, you can be creative while listening. I've seen it happen. I've worked with those directors. It's really exciting when it happens.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Can you imagine the butterfly that I saw where... the butterfly stabs Suzuki, no, slashes Suzuki, stabs the baby, and when Pinkerton comes in at the end, butterfly is hiding behind the Soji screen with a butcher knife when the curtain comes down.
I would be laughing my ass off.
I mean,
that's hilarious. You know, that's awesome. That's a comedy, man. I'd love to see that.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, it's more realistic, maybe.
Some of us are really comfortable with Butterfly being a victim, so there you go.
Yeah.
She is now a mass murderer. Are you happy?
Psycho.
All that pent-up frustration.
Oh, yeah.
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 Well, yeah, I mean, this topic kind of can spread in so many different directions, because, I mean, like, the stories... like we've been saying, specifically about a set, and then there's a whole other issue, like we've gotten into a bit here, of interpretations that might not... it's hard, though, I find, because, I mean, often the loud critics, audience critics, you know, it's a small group, so it's really hard to know sometimes, like, what the audience really thinks about something. It's interesting, yeah.
If you don't try to ask them, then it's really hard.
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know, the problem with all the financial woes of these companies is that, you know, they need more butts and seats, they need more audience, the potential to run more shows or something. And so I don't understand why you're alienating these same people. I mean, it's circular or something. You know, I realize that they might not have the tools to sort of do... a workshop production of something, and that's not really the way that opera productions work, especially when they're sort of moving around from house to house. But it shouldn't be the director above all. It's not, you know. There are also artists to think about in the meantime. I've had, you know, friends of mine that have struggled to do what they know how to do really well because they're doing it upside down or off stage or, you know, and these things need to be balanced with what the piece is and what the audience can get out of it. And if you clear away all the stuff that keeps audiences away, like a language barrier or perhaps length of show or meaningless music for hours, directors can fill in the gaps for the audiences without super posing anything that doesn't exist.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, again, it's one of these topics that comes around every few months, and we'll no doubt be talking about it again in the future. I just want to thank everyone for coming in on this frigid, cold morning. I tried not to mention the weather today because it's so Canadian to do that, but it has been horrible in Toronto last week. So thank you very much for tromping through the frigid temperatures, and we'll no doubt all meet here again soon. And just to remind our audiences that you can listen to these podcasts directly on our website, coc.ca. And if you just go to the, actually, we're transforming, I should mention this. We call it COC Radio now, but in the next month or so, it's going to be called Look and Listen. And that's where all the videos and audio that we produce here at the COC will live. And you can also listen to our podcast on iTunes and subscribe to it directly there, and it will be downloaded on your personal device or your computer as soon as it becomes available. I guess that's it for today. So stay warm and go see some opera, because the opera season is starting again now in lots of cities across North America. And we'll talk to you again soon. Goodbye.